In one of our recent conversations, I looked at a headline. I think it was a CNN headline that said that Paul Manafort was facing 305 years. And I said, what purpose is served by that? And then I went a step further and I said, sometimes I wonder what purpose is served by taking someone. And of course, because it's Manafort and the Trump implication, this becomes an instant referendum on Donald Trump. And I'd be wiser if I had picked someone who didn't have such a distinct profile. But I wondered what purpose is served by taking someone who has no record and poses no known physical threat to a community and putting them in jail to begin with. I said I wanted to have a broad conversation about white-collar crime sentencing, and there was such an instantaneous reaction, much of it negative, to thoughts that I was expressing. But today's the day. Today is the day. Peter Henning wrote something in the Times not that long ago that began this way. One of the vexing issues in white-collar crime is figuring out the appropriate sentence for someone who usually has an otherwise spotless record and poses no physical threat to the community. Recent cases show how hard it is to determine a just punishment for defendants who have so much going for them yet engaged in criminal conduct. Frank Bowman is the Floyd R. Gibson Missouri Endowed Professor of Law at the University of Missouri School of Law and has written on the subject of white-collar criminal sentencing, and he joins us now. Professor, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
I want to have, as I mentioned in the preamble, a broad conversation about the philosophy of sentencing for white-collar crime. But let's talk about the practical reality in the federal system. What is the guidance in a general sense, and must it necessarily be followed in the conventional white-collar tax evasion or fraud case?
Well, the federal sentencing system operates under a set of rules called the Federal Sentencing Guidelines, which were created back in 1987. Between 1987 and 2005, they were mandatory in the sense that they really bound judges fairly tightly to their rules. But in 2005, a U.S. Supreme Court case called Booker made those guidelines essentially advisory. But they still exist, and judges have to at least consult them before deciding what sentence to impose. So in a case like Mr. Manafort, if he were to be tried and convicted, the judge would consult the guidelines, consider all the factors that are involved, generate what's called a sentencing guideline range, and then consider a whole bunch of other things before trying to decide what sentence to actually impose on him.
Fair to say that the guidelines were a congressional attempt to put some parameters on the federal judiciary?
I think that's one of the reasons that they were initially created. Congress created something called the Federal Sentencing Commission, United States Sentencing Commission, which spent several years writing these guidelines. And one of the ideas was to put some constraints on the discretion of federal judges, yes.
Prison overcrowding and criminal justice reform seem to be buzzwords today, but usually, at least from my perception, maybe you'll disagree, but usually from those who are incarcerated for drug offenses. And it just strikes me that I've not heard anyone, maybe for good reason, pick up the mantle and question whether it makes sense to lock up white-collar criminals.
Well, I mean, first of all, with respect to prison overcrowding and the like, defendants for what most people would think of as white-collar crime do not constitute a very significant proportion of people in either federal or state prison. So I'm not sure to what extent white-collar sentencing really impacts that debate. But, of course, you raise...
Well, but can I interrupt and say, but I hear people say, oh, you know, we shouldn't be locking up people for pot offenses. Nobody gets locked up for pot offenses anymore. So
well,
I think they're contributing necessarily either.
No, I don't think that's correct. I think certainly in the federal system, lots of people are still getting in prison for marijuana offenses, particularly under the current administration. And in a fair number of other states, certainly people who are trafficking in marijuana are still getting arrested. Obviously, in states where marijuana has been decriminalized, that's changing, but people are still getting in prison for marijuana.
Okay, so I interrupted you. I should not have done that. On the subject of rethinking the purpose served by locking up a white-collar criminal, there doesn't seem to be that much engagement on that topic.
Oh, I think there's a lot of engagement among people who do this work. I mean, judges, lawyers, people like myself who are ex-prosecutors and academics. Certainly, there's a lot of thinking about that. And, you know, I think when one tries to figure out what you should do with a white-collar criminal, you need to remember that when we sentence anybody, there are a variety of purposes for doing that. One of the purposes, of course, is to protect the community, as you suggest, physically from people who might be violent. But there are lots of other purposes, and among them is deterrence. If we consider, for example, that people who steal a lot of money or engage in government corruption are doing harms to the community, and they certainly are, one of the things we wanted to do with criminal punishment is deter people from behaving in that way. The difficulty I find with people who say, oh, we shouldn't incarcerate white-collar criminals is one of the difficulties is, okay, well, if you're not going to imprison them, how else are you going to deter them from engaging in this behavior? If you simply try to fine people or take away their ill-gotten gains, that's just a tax on our cost of doing business for corruption or criminality. So certainly I think imprisonment plays an important role in trying to deter people from doing white-collar crime. And what's more, there's also a retributive aspect to any kind of sentencing. That is to say, we as a society feel that if people have done harm, then they owe us some repayment in the sense of some unpleasantness or discomfort that they have to suffer in return. And certainly people who steal lots of money, people who corrupt government institutions have done a lot of harm. And I think ordinary principles of criminal justice suggest that they too ought to suffer some retributive harm.
I'm not Professor Bowman for giving you a free pass, not you, but the white-collar criminal, this mythical figure that we're talking about. I'm just wondering if stripping someone of all of their wealth, ostracizing them, forcing them to work for the public instead of being behind bars is worthy of a national conversation. I mean, what purpose is served by Paul Manafort getting sentenced for 305 years at age 68, to spend the rest of his life in prison for fraud and tax charges?
Well, first of all, Manafort isn't going to get 305 years. I mean, that even if he's convicted, that figure was presumably obtained by taking the number of counts with which he'd been charged and taking their statutory maximum sentences and just adding them up. Even if he gets convicted, he's not going to get anywhere near that if he's sentenced to prison at all. I mean, I would guess in Manafort's case, the number of years he's realistically facing would be somewhere in the range of 5 to 15. I mean, that's still a really long time, particularly for a person of his age. But we shouldn't fall into the error of thinking that when the press puts out these astronomically high numbers of potential sentences, that's what he's really going to get. But I think the question you raise is an important one. I mean, what good is served by putting, say, Manafort in prison for 5 or 10 or 15 years? And I think the answer would be if we conclude that he's really done significant harm to the interests of the country, then, he deserves to suffer some punishment for that. And a reasonable period of imprisonment seems to me not a bad idea. The question, as you suggested at the top of the segment, is how much is reasonable and how do we figure that out? And that's a tough question. It's always a very tough question.
Yeah, I don't profess to have the answer. I first was interested in this subject, I guess, watching Bob McDonnell in Virginia, the case that the Supreme Court ultimately overturned. And in that instance, the Justice Department was recommending 6.5. The defense was seeking just probation and community service. And I remember airing for my radio audience at the time, what do you do with a former governor of a state who has done what McDonald was convicted of having done. In that case, by the way, he received a 2-year term. And then, of course, we all know what happened once the Supreme Court took a look at it. But that was the one that really made me think deeply. How best do you make an example of him in the way that I think was necessary? Not give him a free ride, but also not tie up the resources of the prison system with a guy who's not going to physically hurt anybody.
And that's always the question. I mean, and of course, the question, the really, if you go deep, the real question you're asking is the one that is in some ways unanswerable, and it, for every punishment for every kind of crime, how do you make an equivalence, an equation between the harm that someone does and some number of years in prison? I mean, we judges do this all the time, and they sort of blithely assume that there's some kind of natural equivalence between this kind of harm and that kind of punishment, that number of years. But it's always something of a fantasy, right? We're always, to some extent, making this stuff up. We're making really deeply intuitive judgments about how much pain we ought to inflict on someone for the harm that they've done. I think in the case of white-collar criminals, the other part of the problem is this category of white-collar crime embraces so many different kinds of wrong, right? You raised the issue of the governor. His particular wrong was engaging in arguably, corrupt activities, or at least lending the authority of his office to, private commercial activities and the like. That kind of corrupt or corrupt-seeming activity is certainly harmful, but it's a very different kind of harm than other kinds of white-collar crime, which essentially involves simply stealing money. And we put them all in the same great big lump when we talk about white-collar crime, but they're, of course, very, very different kinds of things, and that makes sentencing much more difficult.
I'm taking away from my conversation with Professor Frank Bowman from the University of Missouri School of Law. Don't hold your breath waiting for criminal justice reform to alter in any significant way the means that we use to deal with white-collar criminals. Is that fair?
I don't know. I think your statement is entirely fair. Yes.
Okay. Hey, I appreciate your having been here, and thank you so much for allowing us to intrude on your day.
No, a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
That's Professor Frank Bowman, ladies and gentlemen, from the University of Missouri School of Law. Now, the way we worded this at Smirconish.com, because I simply wanted to have a broad conversation, a very broad conversation about the way in which we treat white-collar criminals. Please don't personalize this to Manafort, because then it becomes a referendum on Trump.
How about Martha Stewart?
Perfect.
Okay.
Perfect.
That's what I think of.
Okay.
I think of her leaving prison with that shawl that, her fellow, knit her or whatever it was. But she served, what was it, 5 months for whatever she did, insider trading or whatever.
What did
it was.
She do? Yes, insider
remember.
Trading. No,
right?
You're right.
Okay.
You're right. Yeah. Is prison an appropriate punishment for white-collar criminals with no prior record who pose no physical threat to their community?